Light beer, dark money. Agree on something. Politics, culture, and the intersection of faith, freedom, and free enterprise. And now, here are your hosts, Light Beer, Chris Clements, and Dark Money, Sean Noble.
Welcome back to another episode of Light Beer, Dark Money. I'm Sean Noble.
I'm Chris Clements.
And we are more than honored to have my mentor, former boss, Congressman John Shattuck here. This is the guy that gave me my start.
He's not just your mentor.
Well,
I beg to differ on that.
Okay, that's fine. He can be a lot of people's mentor. I mean, and we'll probably get into that at some point. But this is 1994. I met you in 1993 at some kind of Young Republicans event.
That's possible.
At the Wrigley Mansion.
Ah.
I was working for State Senator Matt Salmon in his exploratory committee.
I was going to say, he gave you your start.
Yeah, well... Yeah, I was making, you know, maybe $200 a month or something.
A start is a start.
But then I found out that you were looking for a manager, and I went. It was on a Saturday. We went to, it was in your campaign headquarters, which was behind your old home, which was where they did Goldwater's campaigns from, for the most part, or at least the deep thinking. And I remember that I got there, and you're like, I need some coffee. Make some coffee. And... I made
really?
I had never.
See,
made
I was
coffee.
Ahead of my time having males make the coffee.
let's see if you can actually do something.
Yeah,
go make me a cup of coffee.
So I had never, growing up strict Mormon, I had never made coffee, and I had no idea what I was doing. So I did it, and he took one sip. You're like, oh, this is disgusting. Never make coffee again. And I thought for sure that I was not going to get the job. But I did, and
we won.
Yeah,
that's what counts.
Well, and I can take no credit for that because the way I described the first campaign was I may have had the title campaign manager, but you were really the campaign manager of your campaign. I just
to the
followed.
Chagrin of many of my friends.
Yeah,
and maybe a lot of political observers who say you can't manage your own campaign.
Right.
But I was kind of an exception.
Well, you were definitely an exception, and in part because of your dad. I mean. Stephen Shattuck was...
Not just in part. Totally because of my
dad. Totally because of your dad. He was the ultimate campaign manager. He wrote the book, How to Win an Election. It's still, to this day, something that I recommend to candidates and campaign managers.
If you can find it.
Oh,
I've got copies.
Yeah, I do too. I snap them off Amazon anytime I can. But it is the tome. It's the seminal tome on how to win an election. And so I learned... I can't imagine. I mean, I learned so much from that and then went on to work for you for 14 years. I was thinking about it this morning. I don't know that I was your longest term staff. I was your first, but it may be that two of your district staffers, Pat Curtin and Bruce Radin, might have actually gone longer because they stayed to the very end, right? Because I left after the 2008
election. Bruce didn't stay to the very end. Bruce left a little bit before the end, but not much. And who was the other one?
Pat Curtin.
Oh, Pat Curtin. Pat might have been the longest of everyone.
Because she started in your office about the time you start, you know, in January of 95. Let's see. She was and is awesome.
But it depends if you count congressional service or combined congressional and campaign service.
Yeah. Well, Pat might still have me by a few months because campaign was for, 8 months? And she probably stayed. And
stayed
I was,
longer than that after you.
So, but.
Nitpicking.
Yeah. I feel like I'm one of the longest.
I feel like I should interview both of you.
There you go.
I mean, in terms of your longstanding working relationship and everything that you guys both saw during what was then, you know, the first, in 1994, the first Republican takeover in Congress over 40 years.
Right,
you know,
those were interesting times,
and you know, under the expert leadership of Newt Gingrich,
yep,
and the rise and fall of the quote unquote expert. Yes,
now he's an expert.
The rise and fall of Newt.
The interesting thing was that we both knew Arizona politics from childhood.
Sure,
his mother had gotten him involved in politics or knowledgeable about politics from a very young age. And of course, I'd grown up with it, with Senator Goldwater sitting in the living room talking to my dad, or for that matter, Jack Williams or Paul Fannin or you name it.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe we'll flip this a little bit. I mean, in terms of history, like that first year after the Republicans won, what was that like? I mean, what was the feeling? What were the emotions? A lot got done.
They were incredibly heady times. The freshman class was going to change the way Washington works.
Sure.
And Newt and the incumbents kind of, I'm going to say, played along with that, which means they were willing to make changes and make a lot of changes that helped, but not those changes that diminished their power.
Sure.
So, for example, Chris Shays had pushed the Accountability Act, where every law that applied to other federal employees would also then apply to members of Congress. And we adopted that. And the incumbents who had been there for years said, yeah, we'll live under the rules everybody else has to live under. So that was a substantive change. It turned out that in the midst of doing all that, we cut the Congress's budget, and that meant cutting the committee's budget, which meant they had less money to spend than their predecessors. And 2 years later, they came back and said, no, wait a minute. We were clearly overzealous, and we didn't mean to cut our own budget, so we're going to restore it. And it was one of the points at which the freshman class revolted, then sophomore class, I think, revolted and said, no, you agreed to cut your budgets, and you're going to cut your budgets. And so that was one of the first big fights between more senior Republican House members and the revolutionary class of 1994.
Yeah.
The more senior members wanted to talk reform, the more junior members wanted to do reform. And there's a vast difference between the two.
Well, one thing I remember back in that time, it was also the advent of this idea that every congressman should live in their office, go shower at the in the gym, and not have a residence in D.C. The idea of having a residence and moving your family to D.C. kind of went out of favor during that time. And you had guys like J.D. Hayworth with a mattress in his office. I mean, even to this day, a lot of congressmen don't.
The public thought much about that, but the class, members of the class, thought a lot about it.
Yeah.
The
idea of being accountable to the people and not spending all your time in Washington, and the schedule shrunk. I remember that. And I mean, it became more of a Tuesday, Thursday schedule, so you could get back to the district, where before it was just week long grind.
Well, you got to remember, Democrats are in love with power and huge admirers of government and of therefore of big government. So for them, and they had controlled Congress for decades, eons before that, spending 5 days a week in Washington was no big deal. I'm a powerful congressman, and the federal Congress should run everything. So why wouldn't I want to be in Washington 5 days a week, or what the heck, 7 days a week? I don't need to go home and talk to those hoi polloi that elected me. I don't want that. So Republicans, who at least in theory, those who understood the philosophy and thought about it, said, Washington isn't the be-all and end-all. I want to go home. I want to know what my wife's up to, what my kids are up to, and what my constituents are up to. So that was, in part, the shift in the approach to running Washington. There were also, I think, more upstarts who didn't have the wealth to rent a very, very, very nice place, a place at the Watergate, for example, to live in Washington. And so as a result of that, many did live in their offices, although I think some were proud of that and some were embarrassed by it. So it was not uniformly admired or the uniform ideal.
But I think you're right about because there were so many just kind of out of the blue people who decided to run in this changing time, that you had people who it, like you said, didn't have the, there's no way they could pay their mortgage at home and also have to pay the DC rent.
Absolutely. I mean, I can, you can run down the list. I won't say the name, but just as an example, there's one member of our class who's now still there, been in the Senate for more than half of his tenure there, who his job before getting elected to Congress was as a lawnmower salesman. And if I said his name, you'd admire him and say, wow, he's a smart guy. But there were a lot of regular people,
yeah,
more so than ever, I think, or maybe more so than since the early days of the Republic,
right,
elected in my class, who, for whom this was the most important job they'd ever had. It paid more than any job they ever had. But they also, because they didn't have wealth or come from wealth, many of them had to live in their offices. I mean, the cost of trying to support a house in Washington and a house back home was more than they could take. And then there was also the pressure of, you can't move to Washington and be there full time. One of the funny stories is that I think on the first day after I got elected, so the day after the election, John Kyle said, whatever you do, don't move to Washington. Called and told me that, and John Rhodes called and said, whatever you do, don't stay in Arizona. You need to move to Washington.
Conflicting advice. Well, I think Kyle was right. Certainly for you and for a lot of members of your class, being able to, you know, the shortened week work week in D.C., enabling you to be back in the district working with your constituents. I think the 94 class was more accessible over the following few years than any prior congressional class.
Oh, I definitely think so.
Because I can remember, we just jam-packed district office hours every Monday and Friday, and then weeks when you guys didn't have votes. It was just meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting.
It was constant. You worked when you were there. You worked when you were home. And it was projected that we were real people that you could walk up and talk to. But it was also reality. I remember, I think in my first reelect, Steve Chabot, House member from Ohio, still there, although he was defeated once,
came back.
And then came back. Didn't come back in the very next election, but defeated and then came back, I think, two terms later. Steve did a commercial where he was mowing his lawn and he had a pair of tennis shoes that were stained green from him mowing his own lawn. And I came home and said to you, well, we could do that because I got a pair of those stained tennis shoes. I mow my lawn to this day. So,
it was a different class. As far as I know, you mowed your lawn right up to the last day in Congress, because I remember you mowing your, you probably
mowed
still
last
mow.
Week. I'm ready to quit.
But I'll bet. It's been mowing that lawn for a long time.
Yeah. Well, actually, when one of my lawnmowers died, I didn't have time to go buy one, and I borrowed your lawnmower.
Yeah, that's right.
And ultimately, I never returned it, so I just bought it from him.
Yeah.
And probably didn't.
I didn't.
In those days, he was poor and I was poor, and I don't think I paid him a fair price. But
yeah, that's okay.
You kept me around even though I screwed up things a lot. I was thinking about this morning. I was like, I think I was a pretty decent staffer, but man, I caused you a lot of heartache on a number of occasions. Because I had pretty bad judgment on some instances, but it was just an insane learning experience. I think the thing that I appreciated the most was that you were willing to teach and lead by example. And sometimes those lessons were tough, but they had impact for sure.
Couldn't have been tough. I was always go along to get along, nice guy.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Newt didn't think that. Tom DeLay didn't think that, and Dick Armey didn't think that.
No, that's true. So, but I mean, I think about the fights that you picked with them, trying to keep them aligned with what they campaigned on. I mean, keep in mind they campaigned on the Contract with America. And to their credit, everything got voted on, but they certainly,
more or less,
but they certainly worked behind the scenes to make sure that those votes didn't succeed on some of those things.
So Chris might not know this story, but you know this story. So the story was that everybody pretty much in America that's ever watched any television that's of our generation knows about the Life commercial, right? And so the two kids are standing there, and there's a box of Life cereal, and there's one kid sitting at the table, and he's the younger brother of one of the two, and they're debating whether they should try Life cereal.
Yeah.
And so they say, well, we'll get Mikey to do it. Mikey will do anything. He's the younger brother. So Mikey eats some of the Life cereal, and he likes it.
Mikey likes it. Yeah.
Well, I was Mikey in the class of 1994. Everybody knew that Shattuck was an ideologue, and that if he thought something, he'd shove it right in your face, no matter what. So whenever leadership would say they wanted us to do something that the class as a group didn't want, they'd say, we're sending Shattuck up to tell him, no way. So that was my role in the class. And the classic story, which I think it's worth telling, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, because it relates to the Contract of America. At one point, we've voted on lots of provisions of the Contract of America, but we haven't yet voted on term limits. And Newt and Dick and Tom and the other leadership, I guess that would have included Boehner, all decided that we were not going to vote on the version, the exact version of term limits that was in the Contract with America. We were going to change it slightly. And unfortunately, I don't have a memory that allows me to recall exactly how they wanted to make the change. But our class said, no, wait a minute. We told the nation that we were going to vote on the Contract with America. And if you'll recall, it was printed, short form version in Reader's Digest. They all have it. We go home and do a town hall, and they're all holding the Reader's Digest page. And there's the long form version that gives the full text of everything. Yeah. So leadership decides that's it. We're not voting on that one. And our class meets and says, John, you got to go tell Dick Armey, who controlled the floor as the majority leader, that our class is not going to go to the floor and vote on a modified version of the Contract with America. That would be breaking our word. We had told America we were going to vote on the Contract of America or for America version, and we're not voting on anything else. So I went in to see Dick Armey, and he was just moving into his office, so it must have been fairly early, but it took time to get things done. So we were in 3 or 4 or 5 months by then, and his office was on the third floor of the Capitol. I went in, waited to see him. They said, Mr. Armey, we'll see you now. And I go in, and it's me and Dick, and we have this polite, cordial conversation about various things at the outset. And then he says, so what can I do for you, John? What's the issue? And so I started to tell him that about our class. Our class has met, and you guys have thought about this, and you were thinking about this, and you're going to propose a different version of the Contract of America to be voted on. And it's very pleasant. And I say to him, you need to know, Mr. Majority Leader, we're not going to vote on that version. Our class believes we told America we'd vote on the contract version. And the class think it's wrong to do that. And Dick, in a polite vote, says, geez, John, I don't think the change is all that big a deal. And leadership has decided we're going to vote on this next version. So we're going to. And those who know me well know that I can be a little passionate at times. And I can sometimes raise my voice. And I can sometimes get intense. And I said, no, Dick, we're not voting on that. And he said, yes, John, you are. So there's a little knock at the door, and it's Mrs. Armey. And she comes in, charming woman, very nice. She says, oh, boys, don't let me bother you. I just want to see about putting up some of these pictures that I've got and some of the other decorations I want around the office. So, what are you going to do? Fine. So Dick makes his next point, and his voice goes up a little, and I make my next point, and my voice goes up a little, and Dick makes his next point, and it goes up a little bit, and I make my next point, and now we are just shy of screaming at each other, saying, I don't give a expletive what you and the others say. If you think you can pass it without our votes, by all means, go to the floor and try to pass it. But my class is not voting for it, because that would be breaking our word to the American public. So guess what? It ain't happening. And if you can pass it without us, good for you. And of course, he knew he couldn't pass it without us, because every Democrat was going to vote no. And so he screams something back at me, and Mrs. Armey steps over and says, Maybe I think I'll step out for just a minute. Because she didn't want to be in there listening to her husband and a freshman screaming each other at the top of their lungs.
As I recall, the compromise was that you voted on three different versions.
The compromise was to vote on multiple versions. Yep.
And you voted for every one of them.
I did.
Even though this...
And none of them passed.
Yeah, what's interesting, what people don't know, is that John never actually signed the term limits pledge.
Yeah.
So he supported it when it was up on the floor, but you hadn't signed the pledge. A number of people had. Tom Coburn, Matt Salmon, and some others. And both of them held the pledge.
Salmon did?
Salmon did. Coburn. Yeah. And then absolutely. Coburn came back, obviously. So Coburn,
I thought it was unilateral surrender.
Yeah.
To the left.
Yeah.
When you had guys like, who's the guy from Los Angeles? That was
Waxman.
Henry Waxman. Henry Waxman. There forever.
Henry Waxman. That's the name and, I remember.
Still being a good
other
staffer.
Yeah.
Who was the other guy that was there forever?
Well, Dingell.
Dingell. You name it. A lot of them that, I was thinking of the...
Charlie Rangel.
Charlie Rangel. For that matter, Mr. Dingell, John Dingell, saw his wife on the floor or on TV just a couple nights ago. She's still there.
This is a seat that John Dingell's dad held for 30 or 40 years, and then John Dingell held for 50 or 60 years.
Yep. Longest and then, sitting.
And then he retires and his wife gets the seat. Yeah. So it's been in the Dingell family for
did he retire before he died or die before he retired?
He retired before he died.
Not
shortly.
Much.
Not much.
Yeah.
I think he knew he was going to.
He had been
to,
sick so. For several, yeah. for a yeah. while.
Who was, when the Democrats were in the majority, who was the chair of Commerce?
Oh, I want to say
because it was Dingell.
It was Dingell, yeah. Because yeah,
whatever,
then,
there
then
were
it went to
there were many hardcore leftists, not progressives,
yeah,
and not socialists like today. But there are many hardcore leftists that had been there for lifetimes. You know, people who had been in the Congress when I was in grade school. Still yeah. there, and I didn't run at a young age. So,
it's fascinating stuff. What, looking back, what are there a couple moments that really stand out when you think about your congressional career? As far as that was a big deal. I mean, you had a lot of big deals.
There were several that I think stand out. Probably two of them that at least come readily to mind have to do with health care. In one instance, Ted Kennedy and a Republican senator were pushing a health care reform bill that didn't move in the direction I wanted. George Bush was president. The bill passed the Senate. Part of what made it a threat was that Charlie Norwood, a Republican medical doctor, who was probably more respected on healthcare reform than anybody because he was a medical doctor, went along with this Senate-passed patient what would they call it? Patient.
It's a Patient Protection Act or Patient Bill
Patient
of Rights?
Patient Protection Act. Patient's Bill
yeah,
of Rights.
I remember that.
Right. And so it was going to come, it did come to the House. And the concern was that it was going to allow people to sue medical plans in state courts. And state courts are controlled by the tort bar. And the Bush administration said publicly that they might go along with the Kennedy version of the bill if there was some way to say all the other procedures would be run by states, but any litigation would have to occur in federal court. Well, being a lawyer, I looked around and saw that under the Railroad Act, that's exactly what Congress had done some 50 years earlier. They had said, okay, we're going to have the Railroad Act. Different states can set their rules, but if a railroad worker wants to sue, he's got to do so in federal court. So Hastert was speaker, and I went to him and said, I think I've got an idea for the Bush administration. They want to do this. So he called Bush's, I don't know who he called, somebody at the White House, and said, you need to talk to John Chaddick. And so Bush's chief of staff,
Josh Bolton,
called the office and said, we understand that from Speaker Hastert that you have an idea for us. We'd like to hear about it. We said, sure. And they said, but we don't want to meet in your office. Mr. Bolton will come to the Capitol, but he's going to go to, I don't remember whose office, Fred Upton's office or some other office. They wouldn't come to my office for whatever reason. They didn't want to see, meeting with a conservative. So Josh Bolton's a very bright guy, you know, like Harvard or Yale or whatever, top of the top. So he comes in with kind of an attitude and, you know, kind of, so what is it, Mr. Chaddick, that you think you know that Mr. Hastert would be impressed? Remember, Hastert was just a wrestling coach, so he couldn't know anything. And how could a hick lawyer from Arizona, freshman or sophomore member of Congress, know anything? So he kind of probably thought this was a waste of his time. So I pulled out this portion of the Railroad Act and showed him how it worked and what it said. And it basically said, you know, here's the deal. Here are the laws that govern it. States can have this much control, but if there's a trial, it should occur in federal court. And he said, yeah, well, you know, I see that, but we'll have to have our people check it out. We'll have to have our lawyers take a look at it. So thanks for your time. So it was like, I walked out of there thinking, even if he wasn't cordial and or at least respectful and somewhat impressed that a freshman or a lawyer from a hick state like Arizona might know something worth knowing, he would by the end of the meeting. Not a chance. He said, we'll get back to you. So the phone rings 3 days later and said, and in his, he was literally, it was like he couldn't believe this is Congressman Chaddick. I said, yes. He said, our lawyers say you're right. And it was like he couldn't believe it. It was like, how could that happen? How could a lawyer from Arizona know something that we don't know? So that was a high moment.
You know what's so interesting about that? But you bring up...
They actually put the language in the bill. And as a result of that, they got Charlie Norwood to agree to put it in the bill. As a result of that, the trial lawyers weren't happy. The Democrats defeated the bill. And after the defeat of the bill, I was in Hastert's office kind of celebrating the day it went down. This was a huge deal because they thought they were going to have to veto this bill.
Sure.
And I start to leave. I say, I got to go. And Bush's liaison to the Republican Congress is in there, all high-fiving and celebrating, and Hastert's there, and we're all having a good time. And he turns to me and says, no, you can't go. I said, what do you mean I can't go? And he said, no, you can't go. And I said, I got to go. I got it my own fundraiser. And he said, well, then give me your cell phone number because the president's going to call you and thank you. And he did.
That is one story amongst, I would say, I mean, many about, there's something special about Arizona politics.
Oh, there is.
And there was a great article, I think, in National Review this week about, you know, this whole fascination right now with Kyrsten Sinema and what she's doing in the Senate and who she is and why is she acting this way. And yet they trace it back to this idea that, you know, maybe Arizona isn't as conservative as we think. It's more contrarian.
Yeah.
And there's just a list of, you know, a lot of people go to Congress and they do absolutely nothing. They're there, they have a seat, it's a safe seat, and they don't want to make any waves, and they don't want to, they'll vote for bills, they'll introduce very little, they'll do very little. They might focus on constituent services or whatever else, but they're not really there to do anything. It's more of a title. And yet we have, I think, consistently delegations throughout the decades, and always have, there's always a focus on Arizona. Going back to John Rose, Barry Goldwater, Hayden.
Carl Hayden.
I mean, John McCain, Paul John Fannin. Shattuck. I mean, even in our delegation today, you've got some folks who are rather iconic, and they want to get things done, and they don't care if they ruffle a few feathers to do that. And I think it's really an interesting thing.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it's cultural. On the East Coast of the United States, at least in our lifetimes, people have been acculturated to going along and getting along. So you look at East Coast cities, and they're monolithically liberal. And I think people decide to be liberal because their neighbor's liberal and their other neighbor's liberal or their parents were liberal. You come to the West Coast of the United States, and at least in Arizona, the tradition is what you say. It is conservative, but more than conservative, it's contrarian.
Yeah, almost libertarian.
Oh,
yeah, to the point of...
Well, it's distrust of government.
Yeah.
And the thing that I remember, and I don't know if I remember this from civics or if it just became... If I learned it in civics and then it became more important over time. When Arizona became a state, they had already... the recall of public officials. So you would elect somebody at an election, and then if 2 years into their term or 6 months into their term, you thought they were doing a terrible job, you could hold a recall election.
Sure.
We all remember the attempted recall of Evan Meekum. And so we put in our first constitution submitted to the U.S. Congress so that we could become a state, the recall of judges. So that constitution goes to Congress. House passes, says, ratifies it, says fine. The Senate says fine. It goes to the president, and I'm ashamed I can't remember which president it was. Taft?
Yeah.
Goes to Taft, and Taft, I think, had been a judge, of course. And he says, we can't have the recall of judges. It is writ law in America that judges have to be independent. So he vetoes Arizona becoming a state, because he says, I'm not going to allow a state to have the recall of judges. A judge might make an unpopular decision that is correct under the law or is the right thing for this particular criminal, and then those crazy people in Arizona might recall him, and we're not going to have that. So they sent the Constitution back. Arizona did not become a state. The Arizona legislature pulls out the recall of judges. They didn't demand we pull out the recall of congressmen or state legislators or sheriffs or anybody else. We send it back. Congress ratifies it. Taft signs it. We become a state. And at the very first session of the Arizona legislature, we stick right back into Arizona's constitution the recall of judges.
Yeah.
So stick it in your ear,
right,
President Taft.
Yeah, Arizona has this reputation nationally of kind of giving the rest of the country the middle finger.
And strong leaders. I mean, you think about it. People in Arizona have no clue of how incredibly influential Carl Hayden was.
Sure.
Through the years. They know a little bit about Goldwater. They know about McCain. I tell people that members of Congress travel around the world because they want you to see various things. And so I've made a couple different trips, most of them to unsafe places like Afghanistan. But when I would meet people outside the country, they'd say, where are you from? And I'd say, Arizona. And when I got to Congress, I'd say, Arizona, they'd immediately respond with two words, Barry Goldwater. By the time I left Congress, they'd say, where are you from? And I'd say, Arizona. They'd say, John McCain.
Yeah.
But the point was, they had no clue. They might have had no clue who the senators from Tennessee were, or maybe even not from Connecticut. But they knew it. When I said Arizona, they knew Barry Goldwater, and then later on they knew John McCain, because those guys cut larger than life profiles. I've always argued that Arizona had more influence, and it was true even when I was there, than a state as remote as we are and as little as we are.
Yeah.
John Kyle had outsized influence on national defense, no question about it. John Rhodes.
Yeah.
And the Udalls. The Udalls had outside influence. One of them becomes Secretary of Interior. So it's not Republican or Democrat. It's just maybe it's that they would think for themselves. And in that town, that's a serious problem. You're not supposed to think for yourself.
Your own identity.
Not on the right and not on the left. And the left is just better at doing that, not thinking for themselves.
Well, it occurs to me that we've had very different types of leaders from Arizona. And what I mean by that is, in like Carl Hayden's sense, he got a lot of stuff done.
Oh, yeah.
And in John McCain's sense, he got a lot of stuff done. He also stopped some stuff. But Barry Goldwater, I put you in this category. Your legacy, his legacy, was stopping bad stuff from happening. And so, you know, people say, well, what bills did you pass? And I, you know, it goes back to the classic line from The Conscience of a Conservative. I don't seek to pass legislation. I seek to see what I can repeal, because ultimately the first question is, are we maximizing freedom?
Well, and you look at how vastly the federal government today is expanding its power. Did you ever think for a moment that the United States Attorney General would threaten to put FBI agents in school board meetings to keep parents from becoming involved in their children's education?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, to me, that's a complete outrage. You know, there are plenty of local officials who can stop any threats of violence. There really aren't any threats of violence. But there are angry people, and they're angry because the education establishment is doing things that are outrageous, and people are going to get mad. So this guy, Merrick Garland, thinks he can intimidate, and then they say, oh, we're not intimidating. You know, that's insane to tell the American people, you can go talk to your school board, but there will be an FBI agent there monitoring you, and they may come interview you the day after. I mean, the government has no concept, and apparently Merrick Garland has no concept of the fear that the government strikes in the hearts of average Americans, and in this case, in the hearts of citizens, because an FBI agent comes to see him. They get scared to death. I'm not going to go to school and tell them that the meal service isn't good and the food's cold, because there might be an FBI agent there, and I might get lumped in with those people who don't like critical race theory. So I'm not going to get involved in my kids' education. And yet we all know that across the country and throughout the nation, if the single most critical determinant of how well a kid does in school is whether or not their parents take a role in their education.
Absolutely.
And so Merrick Garland threatens every American not to get involved in their children's education. I think he should be impeached for that this minute.
Well, and it's
or resign.
Yeah, I agree with that. Two things come to mind. One is, thank goodness Mitch McConnell didn't allow him to go on to the Supreme Court.
Get to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, because he knew who he was.
Yeah. Second, this will be very interesting, because I don't know if you saw the clip from the governor's race in Virginia. That election is this November. Greg Youngkin hitting Terry McAuliffe for vetoing a bill that would have provided parents with some oversight. And he's like, well, yeah, because I don't want parents telling teachers what to teach. And it's like the out-of-touch nature of that, I think, is going to...
Well, it's the out-of-touch nature, I think, of the American people. As a nation, we have now been taught that we are subjects of the government, not its masters. The statement by Terry McAuliffe that he doesn't want parents telling teachers and school boards what should be taught at their schools when they elect the school boards and their taxes pay for the school, is just sets the entire American governmental structure on its head.
Right.
Remember, the king ordered us all around. The concept of America was, no. The people are not servants of the government. The government is the servant of the people. And apparently Terry McAuliffe thinks that's wrong.
Yeah.
We should all just do what the government tells us, which is what the progressives and the rest of the radical left, you know, say what you will about Kyrsten Sinema today. When she called herself a socialist, she was embracing the notion that the government should run the people, not the people run the government.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
I just had a thought about education in general. I mean, I think what you're seeing too is the education establishment imploding.
Oh,
after COVID, as we're coming out of this, we're in the endemic now. I think somebody said that the other day. We're not really in a pandemic or an endemic. And so all of a sudden, parents are taking a greater, you know, during the pandemic, a greater interest in what the schools were teaching, what teachers were teaching over that screen. They're hearing what's being taught, and they're outraged. And they're going to these school board meetings demanding change. And so, I mean, what we've seen in Arizona is that the fastest growing part of Arizona education and the most productive part of Arizona education are charter schools and private schools. And you had the head of the NEA or the one of the teachers' unions the other day call out the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, saying, well, we can't allow him to do what he's doing because people will flee public education and go to private schools. To which most people tweeted back, said, hooray, because you failed our children, you've failed our communities, and we're done. And so I think this is the fact that the school board association or whatever wrote a letter to Merrick Garland trying to classify parents as domestic terrorists says all you need to know about the education establishment.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you put your finger on it. It is true that the pandemic had an impact, but what really has had the impact is, and we should all know this as believing conservatives, is competition.
Sure.
The charter school movement has now been in place long enough, and the left has done everything it can to try to kill it. But as with from the ground up concepts that conservatives believe in, like markets, Americans, by the way, Americans of all colors and races are recognizing, hey, competition doesn't just work in grocery stores or because I can go to Walmart. Competition works in education. And if I leave Johnny in the public school, Johnny is going to be handicapped or held back or not do as well his entire life. But if I move him down the street and put him in a charter school, he's going to get a fanatically better education. And so they're deathly afraid of competition, and they're doing everything they can to try to fight it off.
Well, even within public schools, I mean, they've tried to squelch open enrollment here in the state.
Well, charter schools.
Many times.
I mean, charter schools are public.
They are public schools. So, but even if somebody wants to change districts because this district's failing, you can do that in Arizona.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And you can also go to a charter school, which is a public school, but is better. And here's the dirty little secret the public education doesn't want to admit, and that is, as a result of competition by charter schools, the education our kids are getting in public schools has gotten better and is continuing to get better, because guess what? The teachers and the administrators go, we got to get better, yeah, or we'll lose all the kids, which was our argument from the beginning. The allowing some competition in education will raise all education. We're not there yet, but we're headed that way.
Yeah. Well, it goes going back to your point about the fear of government and, you know, involvement in our lives. One of the very early examples of that in your tenure in Congress, and something I got to be a very close participant in, is when there was the joint subcommittee hearings on the Waco fiasco. And there's a funny story, and then there's a not-so-funny story. The funny story is that John was doing a line of questioning, and this is before you had the PowerPoints and stuff. So we have these big poster boards that we've had on these easels. And so there's pictures of different, you know, aerial shots of, you know, the congressman was making a point
pictures
about
of tanks going, yeah, into,
tanks
the
going into the building. And so he's like, you know, next picture, Sean. And at some point I just dropped all the pictures,
knocked the entire easel with all the photos,
all the pictures
over.
And so now they're out of order and I'm flummoxed and you know, these were televised live, a lot of attention.
Joint meetings of the House Government Relations and Oversight Committee, and which was kind of a nothing committee that I was on, and the House Judiciary Committee, which is a big deal, and was chaired by
Chuck Schumer. Yeah,
a big deal. He's back in the House.
Yeah. And you know, this Clinton was in the White House, so there was a lot of communication between the Clinton White House and Schumer's staff on judiciary to try to squelch the investigation. What
you know, the House was doing. I do remember, you know, I went back to the office and, you know, the office had been getting phone calls. Oh, Shattuck's doing a great job. And, you know, and some guy was like, yeah, I'm calling from the Detroit Country Club. Your boss is doing a great job, but he needs to fire that Sean guy. So, that was an example, the FBI going in and essentially murdering, the Branch Davidians, either out of incompetence, it's either manslaughter or murder. But it was horrifying as somebody who grew up fearful. I mean, my first memory, I think I've said this before, is 1976 election night. Went with my parents to the White Mountain Country Club, I think it was, up in Sholo area, and Ford loses to Carter, and my mom's crying, and she says, "Now the Soviets are going to win," and you know, that's where her head was. Yeah. Thank goodness that wasn't the case. But the fear of government was something that I grew up with. I saw it not only during the time that Waco happened, but when we went through the investigation, it was even more horrifying to see what government did to private citizens.
And it pales by comparison to what's happening today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, what is happening today is shocking and scarier than I can ever imagine it would be. I am more afraid and more worried about the country than I ever have. He is the single worst president we have ever had by a gigantic margin. In part, that's because he surrounded himself with radical progressives. And I think one of the greatest threats to a democracy is when the people in charge of the policy are not themselves elected. I think that he is being told to do, and he is doing, outrageous things, in part because the people really making the call are hidden. They're in the background. We don't know who they are. It is clear that the Democrat strategy is to have a completely open border, bring in as many foreigners as we possibly can, distribute them throughout the country to influence future elections, get them there, then pass laws that allow them to vote legally, give them citizenship, or just enable them to cheat and vote. And that will enable them to make sure that Republicans or conservatives never win another election. Now, if the president were making those decisions, then he himself would be taking into account the outrage of the American people. But they've done nothing. This has now been going on for month after month after month. And I thought at first it was incompetence, that, you know, he just didn't know, and the people he put in power didn't know how to control the border. They've had plenty of time to fix it. They don't want to fix it. But interestingly, what that means is that the people who made the decision to have an open border are behind Biden, and they can hide. There will never be history books written that, Susan Rice actually made that decision, such that when a presidential history is written, they'll say, well, one of the most dramatic things that happened in 2021 was millions of aliens came into the nation and voting patterns changed, and that was a decision by Susan Rice. There might be a background book that says that.
Right.
But a president who was... So the decisions being made that affect our lives, like what happened in Afghanistan, the outrage of the exit, the persons who actually made that decision will never be written up in a history book saying they were president and they decided to do this, so they're to blame for it. Or the border. There'll never be something written that says Susan Rice was president and she made the decision to have an open border. Or for that matter, Barack Obama was president in 2021 and he made the decision to have an open border. That will never appear in a history book because they get to hide behind him. So that history that says this did happen on Biden's watch, and if And if the reader then says that was a terrible thing that happened, that reader will blame Biden.
Right.
But Obama will be able to sit back and say, or his historians will say, oh, he never had open borders.
Right.
So he can hide behind that.
Right.
So they're exercising massive and massively damaging power and doing things that are hurting the nation. But the guy that's going to get the blame is Biden, and he's so mentally gone, he doesn't know or he doesn't care.
Yeah, Kim, I think it's Kim a combination. Strassel made a comment on Potomac Watch the other day that they roll him out. He speaks to the teleprompter. They roll him back in behind the curtain. And everybody else behind that curtain, nobody really knows who's calling the shots. I thought that was a great point.
I think he is.
And you brought
up
probably who is calling the shots. I mean, there's been some speculation that this is Barack Obama's team.
Oh yeah,
and he's pulling the strings.
I think he is at the moment, to the extent he is conscious, he is radically more liberal than he has told us.
Oh, always was.
But I think that's because he's really not able to think about those policies and think them through and say, do I really want my name associated with an unpopular radical liberal or radical leftist agenda throughout history, or don't I? He's not thinking about that.
Well, but also,
he's being controlled. He's letting the decisions be made by others.
Yeah, you can't say that in the history of Joe Biden as a politician that he ever had any guiding philosophy. It was whichever way the wind blew for Joe Biden.
Chameleon would change.
Whichever way he was in whatever position he had, he played that role.
I think that's exactly right. And the best example that I think people, at least Republicans, can associate with that, and I think this happened while he was vice president, was he's on the stage, he's speaking to an African-American audience, and he says to the audience point blank, and it's caught in a clip, he says, Republicans, if they could get away with it, want to put you back in chains.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was an original thought by him, but it shows that there's no guidance. There's no moral compass about what is appropriate to say or not say. It was, in fact, reflective of a message they wanted to convey.
Yeah.
And so he was willing to say it without even thinking of how evil that is, which should bring us to the whole discussion of the politics of division. Oh, my gosh.
That's insane.
They have destroyed this country. There was a time when, and this sounds funny, and you're both a little young, but there was a time when after World War II, every American wanted a chicken in every pot and a car in every driveway.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that every Italian American wanted a chicken in the pot of every other Italian American or a car in the driveway of every other Italian American. It was they wanted a chicken in every pot. Other Italians, Germans, Blacks, Native Americans, what we stood for as a nation was the single most important thing was that we were Americans. That was number one. Who am I? I'm an American. That's number one. Not an Italian American, not a Black or African American or Native American. I'm an American. That was number one. And number two was, I want all Americans to do well. So it wasn't that they genuinely wanted all Black Americans to have a chicken in every pot, the vast majority, and a car in every driveway. And the media and the left have now said, no, 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 no. We can't have you be for American. We need to focus on everything that divides you. So if you're Italian American and he's German American, we need to figure out why Italian Americans need to understand they've been screwed vis-a-vis or treated unfairly vis-a-vis German Americans. And so they have taken us all to where the last thing we would say is that we're all Americans. What the first thing they will say is, well, they got a better deal than we did. They were treated better than we were. And so they find, men need to hate women. Women need to hate men. The working class needs
men need to become women. Yeah, women
the
need people to become
who,
men.
The guy who pumps the gas needs to hate the guy that owns the gas station. Not wish he'd get paid more and have a discussion with him. He needs to hate him. And that's where we are in America today.
Yeah.
Division is number one. The number one, so much so that we embrace irrational thoughts. Somehow we've decided that women athletes shouldn't be able to compete against just other women athletes because there are a few people who biologically weren't women to begin with, and we need to treat them fair. So unfairness to all the women athletes, yeah, that's fine because there's a difference there. We need to focus on the difference. The difference is what counts, not the similarity.
Yeah.
It's the difference that matters. We need to divide and hate.
And I think this is a long time coming. I mean, I think this is, and it's really, we've seen the culmination of it, but this has been kind of in the background for many, many years, maybe even generations. And I got to believe that there's going to be a pendulum that swings back, that at the end of the day, people are going to, you know, that care about America are going to say, look, this is America. We are Americans. This is an ideal. We're working for this. We're not going to let you take this away from us. Because I think it's a very small minority that's just super loud. I mean, I think that social media has made it worse. Twitter is
social media has made it
complete dumpster fire that represents just a fraction of real people. So I think this next election will be telling. I think the 2024 election will be telling. But I think it goes beyond just elections. I think it's going to have to be at a corporate level, at an education level.
It's a cultural change. I think about Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater loved Native Americans, and he never thought about what made them different from him or him different from them. And so every minute he could get away when he was a young pilot, he'd leave the store and fly out to the reservation and talk to them and take pictures. He obviously must have loved Black Americans because he integrated both the Arizona Air National Guard and he integrated the Phoenix City Council and the Phoenix City government. So he wasn't focused on what made African Americans or Native Americans different. He was focused on what made them similar and that he and they were alike and could learn from and enjoy each other.
Right.
And today, nobody thinks that.
Well, it goes back to one of the pillars of this show, which is faith.
Yep.
And which is not talked about enough. If you do not believe that you are created, that in the eyes of your creator, that you are not created as a singular human being in the eyes of your creator, then you can't treat everybody else the same.
If you have no concept of God,
if you have no concept of that idea of creation, that we are endowed by our creator by these inalienable rights, that this country was founded on this idea that our rights come from God, not from man, not from government, then it's, you know, it, that is what you're seeing in what you're describing is pulling, you know, what's happened for many, many years, decades, pulling
changing
God,
foundation.
Pulling
our
God out of the public square.
God, and if you believe in God, then you believe in equality.
Yeah.
Now, we no longer believe in God, and therefore, maybe equality is not right. Maybe one group of people is better than the other group of people.
Yeah.
And look at how hostile government is. The other day, on one of the talk shows, they showed pictures of people at an outdoor religious service in the height of the pandemic being handcuffed by police. They were standing 6, 8, 10 feet apart in a big grass field, but they were still being arrested and handcuffed on camera because they weren't wearing masks.
Yeah. And that's where we find ourselves today.
And here we are.
But the rioters can go to Portland, Oregon or Seattle, Washington.
And burn it down.
And be shoulder to shoulder and burn it down.
Yeah.
And then Nancy Pelosi says, we're going to investigate January 6th because that was clearly evil, but we're not going to look into anything that might have led up to it. So it will not be in the jurisdiction of this special committee to look at what happened in Portland or Seattle or
Los Angeles,
Minneapolis. Yeah. You bet.
Well, yeah, we can keep going, and we'd like to invite you back for another session.
You can tell
I don't get excited about any of these things. So.
Before we started, we had talked. I said, "Oh, well, let's try to break this into two." And well, that clearly didn't work. So we'll just have to have you back.
There you go.
One of the things I do, real quickly as we come out of this, is that just as a former staffer of yours, and I just think that when I think about legacy, I just think one of the great legacies that you have as a congressman is the people that you produced, and not necessarily me, but you brought people into your office that went on to do amazing things. I mean, you've had top level lobbyists, you've had people in the White House at the top levels, you've had very successful business people, you've got somebody that's a fashion influencer on Instagram. What I think of when I think of, you know, what your legacy as a congressman was, is I just look at all the people that worked for you and what they're doing now, raising families or being successful in business or in government. And I think that speaks tomes to your legacy, and I appreciate it.
Well, it's kind of you to say. I hope I've had some positive impact. I was a little pleased. You asked why I took the job as master. I was a little pleased that both sides thought I would be fair. So,
One thing I will say, you have in the 20, I don't know, 25, 27, 28, I don't know how many years we've known each other now, you've always been fair. That's been a total common theme.
And you've always taken time with people. So
Steve and Jeannie Shattuck taught the Shattuck kids that it was vitally important to be fair and to treat all people equally, because in the eyes of God, they are all equal.
Yeah.
And that's the single most important thing to understand.
Well, that's a great way to
wrap this up. Until next time on Light Beer, Dark Money.
Yeah. Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all the other
LinkedIn,
social channels.
All the wonderful channels. And Congressman, thank you so much for being here. God bless you.
A lot of fun.
And we'll have you back here soon.
Thanks, guys.